You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, stream our show at nprnews.org/listen live every weekday at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, the comfort and the sustenance our gardens are giving us this summer. You don't have to work at the Arley Burpee Company to know why seeds are selling at the fastest clip in more than a century. Gardening can be comforting in a time of chaos. It's a distraction for restless kids, and it's fulfilling, of course, to see a vegetable sprout or a flower bloom when so much of our lives feels like it's been in limbo. So we thought this midsummer moment was a good time to see how your garden is growing and what kind of advice and help that you need. You could also just brag a little bit. Maybe you want to tweet me a photo of the bounty of your garden like Steve did, and I retweeted it, and you can see all the cucumbers and the tomatoes on Twitter. So I want to know whether you planted something a little unusual this year, or did you go pretty traditional? Are you spending more time in your garden? What do you need to know to keep the bounty coming? Maybe you need some advice because things just aren't growing as you hoped they would. We are taking all questions, and I'd love to see a photo of how your garden looks if you're game to share that with me, and then I'll share it on Twitter. So 651-227-6000 for all of your questions about gardening, 800-242-2828. And if you're hanging out with me on Twitter this morning, shoot me a picture. I'll share it. Or, you know, just send along maybe a question of something that you've been wondering about. It's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Julie Weisenhorn is with us. She's an associate professor in horticulture at the University of Minnesota. And she's in Mound. Julie, it's good to have you back on the show. Long time no chat.
Hey, Carrie, how are you this day?
I'm doing really well. My garden is not, so I have a few questions for you, too. Good to have you back. Catherine Grant is with us, a biology department greenhouse manager at the University of St. Thomas. Catherine, that sounds like a really great gig. I bet you're busy this time of year, huh?
Yeah, I am. Not in the greenhouse, though. It's too hot in the greenhouse.
Is
but
it?
I am outside
okay.
doing a lot of work.
All right. Yeah. I know we'll have a lot of good questions for you, and I'm really glad both of you are here to field them. So, Julie, you've been at this for a long time. I don't know how much of your own food you grow. Do you have a pretty good garden at your own house?
Well, ironically, I think if people saw my garden, they would realize it's not that big from a square foot standpoint, but I pack everything I can into every square inch. So I've got some crops, like I've had a really great year for basil, and I've got chard and cucumbers are coming out my ears, and also have some beans growing too, and yeah, a bunch of herbs. I like growing sage in particularly. I use a lot of it through the year. So I've got that growing too. A lot of pollinator plants, though. I'd say a majority of my plants are pollinator friendly.
Okay. So I want to ask you about cucumbers real fast because I got this great photo from Steve. And it was he said it's like a mini harvest. He probably has many more cucumbers to be picked. Why is this an especially good year for that?
Well, I think that we've had a combination of cool and warm conditions. A lot of times with some of these cucurbits, they really need these conditions to be just right so that you get both male and female flowers. And it's been a good year that I've heard from lots of people. The people who complain about no squash or no cucumbers, no melons may have also a pollinator issue where they haven't got enough bees around.
Ah.
And you really need those bees to be pollinating, to bringing the pollen from the male flowers to the female flowers in order to get any fruit. So, but it's been good conditions for that.
Yeah, Catherine, Kathy Werzer was telling us before we started the show that she planted beans and some other, what she thought was going to be warm weather plants. And it's up there at her mom's house, right on the shore of the lake, and it's not doing very well. So their conditions up there, I guess, are cooler than ours. What's happening with beans mostly?
Beans, actually, I'm not a big bean expert. I don't know, Julie, if you are, but I know down here in the city, the Japanese beetles love them, so they're getting decimated. The leaves are by those. And I know tomatoes, obviously, are a warm season crop, so they're doing well down here where it's warm. But the saying, right plant, right place, also goes for vegetables. So if you're trying to push a crop that wants a lot of really good, strong, sunny days and warm weather, and growing it in a place where it's, you're not guaranteed for that kind of weather, you're probably not going to have a good harvest.
Okay. So, Julie, just a quick note on beans here before I go to the phones.
So I think with beans, it's the timing of starting beans. I started mine kind of late, and while they're growing, they aren't flowering quite yet. They have quite a few buds on them. So I think it's also, I think it's timing too. And we had kind of early spring this year, actually. People were getting out in their garden a lot earlier. But you know, sometimes you just don't get around to it and you go, oh yeah, I better stick these in the ground. And that's what happened to me. So I've got a nice looking vine, a number of vines, but I don't have any beans yet. So, so I'm crossing my fingers. I get some before frost.
We have a lot of questions about tomatoes, so brace yourselves. Here comes the callers to Josh in Coon Rapids. Josh, it sounds like you grow a lot of different tomatoes. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. I've got the little cherry tomatoes, the bigger red curd tomatoes, and we San Marzano tomatoes this year.
And how's it going?
Awesome.
Everything's going great. We've got tons of tomatoes, but my question is, our San Marzano tomatoes are having blossom end rot, where like the ends of them are rotting, and none of the other tomatoes are affected. The rest of them are doing great. And I'm just wondering if I can get any advice on that.
Well, that's pretty weird. Julie, why would one kind of tomato not do well when the rest are?
Well, San Marzano tomatoes are plum tomatoes or paste tomatoes. They have a thicker wall. They are prone to the blossom end rot versus, say, the big beefsteak tomatoes that you'd slice up for like a BLT. And calcium deficiency is the reason for the blossom end rot. And it usually happens early in the earliest fruiting, the earlier fruits on the vine. And then it kind of will stop after a while. But what happens is it's not that you don't have calcium in the soil. It's that it's due to uneven watering, and meaning that sometimes you'll go away for the weekend, come back, and your tomatoes are completely wilted. You're like, oh, darn, I got to water those. So you dump a bunch of water on them. Then they dry out again, and then you dump more water on them. So you have to keep them regularly moist. And that's a challenge of growing tomatoes. It's also a challenge if you have them growing in a container too, because those containers, like a big pot, is going to dry out a lot faster.
So it's more of like an irrigation kind of thing with tomatoes, and less of, they look like they need water, I'm just going to sprinkle them for a while. Is
right.
that right? Okay.
Right. You want to keep them evenly moist as
Got
best
it.
You can. Mulching the plant is really helpful. And we do have good information on the Extension website, Yard and Garden, about blossom end rot and how to resolve that.
Catherine, Lou is on Twitter. She says, everything in my Pepin, Wisconsin garden came from the greenhouse of your guest, Catherine Grant. Wow.
Yeah, this is why I don't tell my friends that I'm on the radio beforehand.
This is why. She's got some beautiful plants here. And, this looks like squash. I thought we were hearing that squash was a little behind. So what's the deal with this? You give people little small plants, and how does this work? Why is that better than planting a seed, I guess?
Well, actually, I think I just gave her the seeds this year. This year,
okay.
I didn't grow them. A lot of people feel like when it comes to vegetable starts, that especially new gardeners, that they have to get something that's been started in a greenhouse, which is true for some crops that have longer growing periods, like tomatoes, peppers, eggplant, stuff like that. But for tomatoes and cucurbits, any cucumbers, you can put the seed in the ground yourself once it's at the right temperature. Keep it watered for a few days, and you'll have a very happy plant. A lot of vegetables, if you read the seed packets, it says preferred method for sowing it. It'll either say direct seed it right into the soil, or to grow it early and then transplant it just to get a leg up on it. And I do believe I gave Lou some seeds for some squash.
I'm glad Lou tweeted. Beautiful photo. Yeah, I want to tell everybody, if you're near Twitter this morning, I'd love to have you come on over and check out some of these beautiful photos that I'm retweeting, because people are sending. I'm amazed at what kind of vegetables they're getting already only halfway through the summer. And that's what we're talking about this morning, if you've just tuned in. We're talking about gardening with Julie Weisenhorn from the U of M and Catherine Grant, who runs the greenhouse at the University of St. Thomas. I'm interested in whether you're experimenting a bit with some new plants in your garden. Are you going traditional? And what kind of advice do you need? Are you running into some problems with those tomatoes? Are you seeing your seedlings kind of fall behind? I've had some problems with that. I'm going to ask Catherine and Julie about it. What can we help you with in your garden? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. And on Twitter at @CarrieMPR. Catherine, let me ask you this about the seeds, because Leaf tweeted, "Our garden hasn't shown much progress in the last couple of months. Are we doing it wrong?" And he's showing me these little small containers that look like they were growing out of seeds, but he doesn't have much to show for it. So what might he be doing wrong?
I wish I could see the picture. Was it that he started the seeds from at home and they're not growing well?
That's what it looks like to me. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know specifically, but sometimes when people start seeds at home, they're not really starting them with the best conditions. So maybe they don't have either enough quantity of light or quality of light, not enough warmth. And sometimes when you germinate seedlings on a windowsill, they stretch really far, and you never can kind of get over the fact that they stretch too far. And or maybe you watered too much and the roots get a little bit rotted, or they're just not healthy root systems. So when you plant them, they just don't overcome that they got a bad start in your house. That might not be the problem. That is oftentimes a likely issue for okay. people who do seeds start at home.
Good yeah. to know. That might explain what happened to me too, because I planted some seeds of some wild thyme and some others, and it just isn't doing very well. And I thought, well, do I not have enough soil? I don't want to load too much on. Is this a thing where it's just kind of behind? It's behind the season a little bit?
Yeah, thyme. I grow the thyme in the greenhouse, so I have perfect conditions, right? And it's a very long crop to grow out, and it's very spindly in the beginning. So it maybe takes 10 weeks in the greenhouse to look okay. And then it just gets a little lanky, and it needs to be outside.
Okay, this is good to know.
So,
call here from Cindy in New Hope. Hi, Cindy. Hey, Cindy.
Hi, good morning.
Yeah, what's your question?
Well, my question is related to some of this conversation where I'm doing seedlings. I grew my tomato seeds indoors a few months in advance.
That's good.
And when I planted them, what I found out was that I already had a huge crop in my garden that had grown up all on their own without me planting the seeds. Of not just my tomatoes, but I had one tomatillo plant from last year, and then I ended up with about 30 tomatillo plants.
Wow. So and now what are you doing?
Well, I took some out, but I'm just letting them go, and they're going like gangbusters, much better than the seeds I planted. And I'm just wondering what conditions caused that to happen.
Yeah, and maybe how you clear out some of the plants or something. Julie, what do you think?
Well, those volunteers are really handy sometimes. They can create a garden all on their own, as you're finding out. So tomatillos are notorious for dropping fruit. You don't quite get to all of it. It drops down in the ground, and those seeds stay in the soil through the winter, and then they emerge on their own when the temperatures are just right in the soil. So oftentimes when people grow tomatillos, I warn them. I say, you're going to have tomatillos for many years to come. And tomatoes will do the same thing, especially cherry tomatoes, because they're very small, and they've dropped down. You know, maybe some of them rot down there, and the seeds are there, and they sprout when they're ready. So congratulations. That's pretty cool.
Be careful what you wish for on the tomatillos, though. Is that what I'm hearing?
Pretty much.
Our engineer, Veronica, right across behind glass from me, says, my yellow squash plants are gigantic and flowering, but none of the flowers are turning into squash. She says, am I just being impatient, or should I just accept that I'm going to be squashless this season? Oh, say it isn't so, Julie. What can we tell V-Rod?
Well, squash are pollinated by squash bees, And so you want to encourage bees and pollinators in your yard around the squash. Sometimes, depending on weather, you get a lot of male flowers on your squash plant and not a lot of female flowers. You can tell the females because they have the ovary at the base of the flower is kind of bulging like a tiny squash. And you can hand pollinate them. You can go out and look for the male flower and then look for that female flower and just take a little Q-tip and dab a little of the pollen from the male anther onto some of those female flowers if you're not seeing any bees, but you can see the difference between the two flowers.
She just said in my ear, I had no idea. I think she just thought, I'll throw them in there and see what happens. So, but she's very resourceful. So I have a feeling there's squash coming in her life. Okay, Julie, we mentioned bees. This is a good time to talk about the backyard bumblebee count that's coming up. And I know our listeners can get pretty excited about this. How does it work?
So this is a count. It starts tomorrow, July 24th, and it goes through August 2nd. And it utilizes an app called iNaturalist. You can download it. It's free. And what we're asking is for people to post pictures of bumblebees. And we will have the link for this. We can post that out on your Twitter account, Carrie.
Love it.
We can, and we'll put it out on to our Yard and Garden news as well. And we are looking for the rusty-patched bumblebee, but all bumblebees in particular. Rusty-patched is our insect of the state, and it is an endangered species. And so we're hoping this is kind of the perfect time to see the rusty-patched bumblebee. So we're encouraging everybody to get involved.
Catherine, you have a lot of rusty-patched bumblebees there in the greenhouse and fields around it?
Well, as a matter of fact, I just had a positive ID on one a couple days ago. We have a big garden. The biology department has down on some undeveloped land by the river, and there's been what's called a stewardship garden down there doing research for many years. And all the vegetables, I think, there's a large population of diverse pollinators down there. And this year, because we didn't have students because of COVID, in the spring, there was a bunch of beds that were about to go to weed that I volunteered somewhat strangely. I don't know why I did it to take over them.
You're a good
woman.
It's
a lot of work.
Wow.
And I regretted it because it was a lot of work, but now the work's paying off because instead of putting in vegetables, which require harvesting, which requires labor, right? I put in a lot of plant seeds and plants because I have this greenhouse where I have a plant sale, and I couldn't have the plant sale this year. So I've pretty much put my plant sale down there. So anyway, the other day I was down there, and normally I see the rusty patches here on either giant hyssop or Joe Pye weed, but I saw one on this other plant, Ageratum, which is a pretty common annual. And it's funny when you see one, they're a little bit bigger than your normal eastern bumblebees. And when they spread their wings, you get a little tiny glimpse of the brown of the patch.
Okay. I wondered how we'd identify them. Okay.
So you stand there with your phone. I took a video of it just so I could go back and look at that moment when it opened its wings, and I happened to get a good still shot of it. So it
cool.
Was,
Catherine, you have to tweet one. That. You have to tweet that at us.
Okay, I'll do that right now.
That will be great for identifying them as people go into their yards to count. So that'll be valuable.
Yes, it was a good one. Anyway, so we do have rusty patches here. We see them, it's usually on those two other plants. And it just takes a lot of looking to get used to looking for that particular bee. It's pretty exciting when you see them.
Boy, you got to see the photo that Tim just tweeted. He says, just took these pics of my gardens with one of my regular monarch visitors. He's got this beautiful photo of a monarch butterfly hanging out on this. I'm trying to think. That almost looks like a zinnia. I'm not sure what that is. Tomatoes are coming in slowly. Zucchini number one was picked last night. And later this morning, the first green bean harvest. Also basil by the bushel this year. Pizza on the grill yesterday. Boy, you are living large there, Tim. And Rob says, extra garden produce can be donated to kids in Minnesota in food insecurity. Grow and give. So I have retweeted the link on that. And if you've got tons of stuff coming into your garden, this is a place where you can help contribute. Okay, to the phones to Susan in Northfield. Susan, we are getting so many questions about beetles. What do you want to know?
Good morning. Last year, I planted two apricot trees, and one of them, Japanese beetles love it, and they're just chowing down on the leaves. And I also have a question about I remember from someone's garden some bush cherries that were sour, but I can't seem to find them anywhere at any of the nurseries.
Okay, so what do you do about first the beetles on the apricot tree? Catherine, can you tackle this?
Well, trees are tough because the best method for getting rid of Japanese beetles right now is to pick them off one by one and drop them into a container of soapy water, and that lets them drown and coats them in the soap. A tree is tougher, and the bad news is that a systemic applied to it, which also kills bees, is one way to kill them. One thing you should know about Japanese beetles is they're not always just eating your leaves. So the telltale sign you have them is that they've desiccated the leaves, right? Mm-hmm. But they also like to drink the nectar. And oftentimes when you're picking them off, you find them buried in the flowers, and they're actually, I think, eating when they're there. I don't know, Julie, do you know a non-toxic way to bees that you can get rid of beetles on trees?
No, it's difficult. Those Japanese beetles are real buggers, and we have to live with them. So that's one of the, when you talk to Jeff Hahn, our entomologist, he'll say they are here to stay. So we all need to kind of roll with it. But most of their issue is cosmetic, and most of it to defoliate a tree completely is fairly, kind of random. It's not the norm. But you can try to blast them with water from your hose, but they fly. They're strong bugs. They can fly miles. And treating a tree because of the Japanese beetles, we really discourage it unless the tree is a very young tree and the tree is going to literally die from it. So
you're saying,
I'm really sorry to hear about it.
For the most part, you kind of have to let them do what they're going to do, Julie?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I'm afraid so.
Oh,
the traps, you don't want to hang the traps because they will just attract them from all over the place to your yard. So they are used to monitor, but they're not really used to trap and kill the beetles. So
okay.
We have great information on that on the extension site.
We do have another question here about beetles to Marianne in St. Cloud. Marianne, did what Julie and Catherine tell you already, did that help, or do you have an additional question about it?
Well, I do have an additional question. Someone told me that you can put in a squirt bottle, like Dawn soap, with the water and a little bit of vinegar, or not, maybe, I don't know, I just kind of pour it in, and then I squirt it on there. It seems to daze them, and I just drown them in it, and they just fall off the leaves. But it's a persistent problem.
Yeah. It'd be hard to do with a tree.
There's a black beetle with kind of an iridescent shell, right?
Yep, that's
coppery colored.
Yeah.
No,
the soap does help. The other day I was down at a garden and I didn't have any soap, so I just was drowning them in plain water. And they don't drown as quickly in the water without the soap in it. So use the soap.
One thing to be cautious about with the combination that you've stirred up is that that can be a contact. That's a pesticide. Basically, you're using it to kill something. But that can also be an issue with small bees and hoverflies that might be around. You may not see them, but you may also, if you're dousing the beetles, you could also be inadvertently dousing those beneficials too. So it's really it's a fine song and dance between Japanese beetles and the home gardeners. So
yeah, you kind of just have to put up with them is what I hear you both saying.
Yeah. Or choose not to grow plants that they like, which is over 350
Impossible.
Different kinds. So.
Oh my gosh. Is it really?
They like a lot of plants.
The key though is that if you can reach them, you can pick them off.
Yeah.
And I know people who find it rather zen-like to come and in the morning when they're, you get them in the morning. When they're sleepy, they don't fly away as quickly. And you just put I found a yogurt container is a good size, like a 2-pound one. You just plop them in there and they just drop in and you can get some satisfaction out of it, honestly. So try to turn it into something meditative.
One of the other things about Japanese beetles is the more they feed, the more beetles are attracted to that site. There's something that Potter, who's a University
they
of Kentucky,
are villains.
I think he's retired now. Man. He's found that there's something that the plant puts out that attracts more beetles to the feeding site. So you got to stay on top of it.
Yeah.
And the more you get out there and the more you're picking them off and the less damage you have, the right. better you're going to be in the long run.
I have to say, I don't know how zen-like this would be for me, Catherine. And what I was talking about,
it's
you know,
more satisfying.
I was talking about respite and renewal in the garden. That wasn't quite what I had in mind, but okay. Catherine Grant.
Go ahead. The unfortunate thing about when, especially for new gardeners or any gardeners, is you don't get to garden or deal with plants without also dealing with the insects
yes,
that
for sure.
feed on the
yeah.
plants. You have to sort
That's
of
so
come
true.
To terms with that and be
right.
interested in them as well.
Yeah. Catherine Grant is with us. She's the Biology Department Greenhouse Manager at the University of St. Thomas. And Julie Weisenhorn is an Associate Professor in Horticulture at the University of Minnesota. A reminder again, I know you guys are sharing this backyard bumblebee count. It starts on July 24th. It goes to August 2nd. I've retweeted the link from Julie for where you can send your photos in. But there's a lot of information online for that, too, at the U of M. So check that out and take part in that. And we're going to get a look at the latest news. And when we come back, more of your calls and questions. It is gardening in a time of seeking, I think, more respite, even if that means just pulling bugs off a plant in our gardens. And I'm curious about whether you're growing something a little experimental, just doing the same traditional thing. What kind of challenges are you running into? Okay, back to our conversation about gardening. A question here, Catherine, from Margaret on Twitter. She says, how do I get rid of small jumping white bugs on my flowers that leave something looking like snow white flakes or mold and it rots the stems? She says, I've started spraying with soap, but I don't want to destroy my butterflies or bees. Do you know what those bugs are?
Small? Are they hopping or are they flying?
She says they're jumping.
Julie, does that sound like I just think a white fly, but
yeah,
I don't know
that's what I think
jumping.
Of too.
Yeah,
right.
What's it called?
White flies.
Well,
white flies.
White
okay.
flies.
They fly though.
they do fly.
Okay.
But, so she should do I guess go on the University of Minnesota Extension website and try to ID it. Usually, before you treat something and spray things on your plants, you want to know what the pest
yes.
is that you're after. Then you need to know what. Life stage it's in, because at different life stages they are susceptible to certain pesticides. At other life stages it's just too late. You also might want to know is this their are they at the end of their life cycle, in which case just let them go. You know that, so there's a lot you need to know about the life cycle of the pest, but you have to begin with identifying it, and the U of M does have resources to help you do that.
Okay, sounds good. To the phones, to Ross and Excelsior. Ross, you're going flowers. Yeah. How's it going?
Hi. Good, good. I was just wondering, my wife and I are doing a cut flower garden for the first time this year, and we're just starting to get, like, larkspur and zinnia. We have poppies, but that's essentially it, and we have a lot more that look like they'll be budding soon. Cosmos and sunflowers, but I was wondering, is there anything that we can do to encourage earlier blooms or just have more so that we don't just have an abundance in August
yeah.
and September?
Okay. So, Julie, how do you get more flowering out of your flower garden?
Well, deadheading is a good thing to do. So as flowers fade in your garden, and I know you're doing cut flowers, but as they start to fade and they drop their petals, then you want to deadhead those. And that means you cut down the stem, you remove the dead flower. And the reason for that is the plants put a ton of energy into flowering and even more energy into setting seed. And so you want that plant to be putting more energy into producing more flowers and not setting seed unless you're collecting the seed. So that would be one thing that's important to do, particularly with the annual flowers that you've mentioned. And then being sure that you're watering well enough, you might want to give them a shot of fertilizer. That would also help. You can use an all-purpose fertilizer. I don't know, Catherine, do you use like a high phosphorus fertilizer or anything with the flowering plants that you take care of?
Yeah, you could with flowers for sure. The other thing is to select varieties that bloom sooner. There's a lot of resources now for cut flower growers. There's one in particular. There's a farm called Floret Farm, F-L-O-R-E-T, and they have classes and have published and have a nice book about cut flower gardening, and I'm pretty sure they list each flower by, you know, it's how long it takes from seed to bloom. So part of it might be that you planted things that all do bloom in July and August. So you can't really change that without
a
greenhouse.
That's a good point.
Right. And then, yeah, cutting back is good, different varieties. And then also the heat, and do they get plenty of sun? You know, flowers will bloom slower if they don't get as much sun as they'd like as well.
I got to tell you guys, Whitney just tweeted the cutest photo of what she thinks is a bee napping on a sunflower. Do they do that? Do they actually
rest?
Yeah, they rest and take naps.
This is so great. I retweeted it.
Okay, I have a question for you two about, I have a bunch of Siberian iris, and some years, not this year, but some years, it's just almost like a field of purple. This year, I noticed it was a very brief bloom. And I don't know that I got blooms from all of them. And I just, Julie, I wondered, was it just not a good year for that?
I think with one thing with flowers, too, depending on the time of the year. If, for example, I didn't have a lot of Siberian iris either. I had kind of spotty blooms. But something that I've recently divided mine, that's one thing.
Oh.
It takes maybe a year or two before they settle in and they get enough root growth back to produce some decent flowers. But the other thing is the temperature and the weather. If we get a rainy streak in there or high humidity or something, that can really, you know, shorten the life of flowers in the garden too. So it could have been, that's kind of what I think happened this year with Siberian iris. Mine just, you know, we just had a bunch of rain at the time they were blooming and they just kind of poof, you know, didn't last very long.
So did you divide yours because, you know, I love the idea, you know, kind of the look of it, that it's this huge, beautiful field of purple. But maybe that's inhibiting the blooming or something.
Right. So in Siberian iris, and it's the same with hosta and also ornamental grasses, is when the center of the plant starts to be basically bare so that it's almost like a donut shaped plant.
Yeah.
That's the oldest part of the plant. That means it's time to divide that plant.
Okay.
And so you could have these big masses, but if you pull away the leaves a little bit, you might start to see these kind of bare spaces in the centers of clusters of plants. And that would be indicative that you should be dividing that plant.
Good advice there. Okay. To Sharon in Minneapolis. Hi, Sharon.
Hi there. Hey. Actually, I'm on the Ford Bridge, so I'm between Minneapolis and St. Paul.
That's okay. What do you want to know?
So, I've been gardening for respite this year.
Good.
A lot.
Good.
And I'm enjoying my neighbor's boulevard, so I am happy to redo my boulevard, which is choked up with spiderwort and a very pretty but invasive wild geranium. If I dig out all of that stuff and compost it hot enough, will the spiderwort roots actually compost? They are very, very vigorous plants, as you know.
Catherine, how in the heck does she get rid of those spiderwort roots? What should she do with them?
Well, I would do the lazy route and just bag it up and get it to the city. Like, if you have a compost pile that you know gets hot enough, then you can give that a try, but probably not. Like anything that has rhizomatous, any plant with rhizomatous growth is really hard to get rid of, as you know, and it just takes a lot of persistence and wearing down of it. In terms of disposing of it so it doesn't regenerate somewhere else, I don't know, Julie, what you have to say, but I would say good luck with that.
Well, I think that one of the things about home backyards is that they are really, our compost piles, unless you have a, you know, 40 acres of land, your compost pile that's 3 by 3 by 3 is not going to get hot enough to kill those, as Catherine stated. So one thing about the Tradescantia, the spiderwort, is it seeds a lot. So one thing you can do is get out there and cut those flower heads off. And that will at least prevent it from seeding into other parts of your garden. But you're just going to want to take a nice sharp shovel and get in there and just dig those out. And I agree with Catherine. I would take those to a municipal compost site where they can actually get hot enough and really kill those rhizomes and get them out of your hair.
Yep.
Okay. A call here from Phil in Duluth. Hi, Phil.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
How's the gardening going up there?
I'm happily, it's going fine. I'm happily raising monarch butterflies for the fourth summer, and I just want to recommend that as one way of gardening for respite. There's a little bit of work involved, but milkweed tends to grow by itself, multiply by itself, and the butterflies certainly don't hesitate to lay eggs once they've become familiar with your patch. But my question involves mostly how milkweed fares as being mixed in with one's garden for flowers or for produce.
Okay. So
it tends to spread.
Okay, so you're wondering how much milkweed to actually grow to get more butterflies. Is that right? And how does it do mixed in?
Yeah, mixed in, right.
Got it.
Right.
Catherine, what do you think?
Yeah, I can speak to the mixed in a vegetable garden. It depends on which milkweed you're talking about. Like the common milkweed is once again, rhizomatous, which means it has underground stems that creep along and then new growth pops up every here and there. I have a brand new plot at Dallin Community Garden for vegetables this year, and it's just covered in common milkweed. And so in the very beginning, I took a look at it when I was clearing the plot and said, I'm going to get rid of all of you. I know that's heresy, but I'm going to do it because I'm growing vegetables, not milkweed. And of course, it all came back. And then I relented and said, fine, go ahead and grow. And it is like dominating. It's going to dominate your vegetable garden. I mean, things are intermingling and going okay, but it definitely will dominate. It's a very strong and aggressive plant.
So when you say dominate, does that mean it's crowding out other plants or?
Exactly. It's taller.
Oh,
it's, you know, it's about 3-4 feet tall. You know, my peppers are completely shaded out. And in the world of gardening, sunlight is your food. That's your currency. And if the milkweed gets to the sun before your other plants, then it wins and the other plants just won't thrive.
You know,
so, yeah.
Julie, you want to add anything to that on the milkweed?
I agree 100%. It's a big, tall, beefy plant too. And it also attracts other insects like milkweed beetles. I've seen Japanese beetles and bees on it at exactly the same time. It gets a little sticky. And it can lay down, it can flop down in richer soils. So it can get to be kind of a pain in the backside of the gardener.
Okay. I have to say, apparently Whitney's incredible photo of a bee napping was a challenge to some of you named Julie, who now are tweeting out little videos of what is this, Julie? You said, I caught this guy drinking. What is it?
So it's a bee on an echinacea called Ruby Star.
Oh,
and it's actually, you can, if you look close enough at it, you can see the liquid that it's drinking.
Wow.
It's lapping up
incredible.
In the flower. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. I hadn't had very
incredible.
Much coffee that morning, so my hands weren't shaking too bad.
Okay. I've retweeted Whitney's incredible photo and Julie's video. And wow, some just great pictures of what you're getting out of your garden. Sarah says, garden beds by me, oven by husband, backyard harvest with row 7 seeds, cucumbers. Boy, she's getting tons of stuff out of her garden. You know, we had a question here from Len who said he got let me see if I can find it. I think he said that he got a packet of seeds from China that said they were five peppers or something like that. Here it is. I received an unexpected package from China containing a heart charm and a packet of seeds that a friend translated as five-color sweet peppers. It seems like it would be bad luck not to plant them. Do they grow in Minnesota? Is it too late to plant? Julie, Catherine, what do you know about these peppers? What do you think?
Well, it is too late to start peppers.
It is too late or never too late? It is too late.
It is too late.
Okay,
yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Peppers generally, most vegetable seeds are listed on good websites as days to harvest, right? So that gives you a sense of, I need 3 months for this, 4 months for this, 6 months, whatever. And our growing season is pretty short. It's from May to October. So peppers, you generally want to start indoors in April or maybe March.
Probably March.
Okay. Yeah.
Might be able to germinate them, but you're not going to get any peppers off of them.
But for next year, I mean, what's the harm in giving it a go, Julie? I mean, what could go wrong?
You could certainly save the seeds, and yeah. I would save them in a cool, dry location.
Okay.
And then and keep them sealed up. Don't let them get wet or moist because they'll mold. The one thing I would caution you on is sometimes people send seeds around the world, and that's exactly how we got a lot of the plants in the United States.
Ah.
If you read all back right. around, you know, the 16, 1700s. And, but you want to be sure that you're keeping an eye on those. I would start those and I would put them into a container versus your garden because you don't know how aggressive those might seed. We had the first caller talked about the tomatillos and tomatoes and yay, that's great. But these might be peppers that you don't want a lot of. You might find out you don't like them. And if you've dropped any of those onto the ground, you may find you have them for a long time. So just caution, I would say, because you've never planted them, I would plant them in containers next year.
Good idea.
Good. Okay. Anne in Minneapolis has a question. Hi, Anne. Thanks for waiting.
Oh, hi there. Thank you. I'm wondering if you can help me find a non-toxic solution for a serious problem with aphids covering Heliopsis.
Okay.
So, oh, I had that same problem this year.
They're really bad.
I pulled mine out.
You pulled your
really?
Yep. I pulled mine yep. out. Yeah, they look so bad. I was like, oh. I tried, I sprayed them with water. I used a neem oil very carefully on them because that can also be a contact pesticide for beneficials. But ultimately, they look so lousy, I yanked them out.
Wow. Yeah.
That was my solution.
One thing you can get if you're committed to those is you get a it's called a bullnose attachment for your hose. And you can use that as a nice, strong water spray, and you spray them off, and you beat them down, basically. You keep coming back at them day after day after day. If you have the energy to do that, that's one way to go. But I agree with Julie. There's just some plants that sort of come they have those insects, those aphids will find them, like swamp milkweed always has orange aphid on it.
Right.
Delphiniums. I was defeated with delphiniums years ago.
Oh,
because
they're so
aphids
beautiful
found them
too. Oh.
Every single time. And I think eventually you just give up.
Yeah.
Or else you live with it.
Right. Hey, we had
spray water on them.
We had a call from Courtney in Minneapolis. She couldn't stay on, but I want to ask you guys this question. She says, I can never get watermelon to grow. Is it because the growing season here is just too short? Is that the case, you guys? Catherine.
I think so.
Julie. Yeah.
We've had luck with small melons in the kids' garden. So these are like the stars and what are they? Moon and stars, I think is the type of melon. They only get to be about the size of maybe, not even a soccer ball size. And we've had luck with that. But you gotta get them out there early. That's where transplants would be, better than putting a seed in the ground. You can get a head start on them.
Right.
I know, Catherine, have you had luck with, I've never grown great big watermelons. That's for sure.
I've never even tried, but for that reason,
no.
Although I think at school we did have success one year with watermelons, but what you want to do once again is select the right seed. There's breeders that are looking for a short season, cool weather. There's a lot of vegetable seeds that are for northern climates that have shorter seasons. And, just look for something that says that. Julie's right. Pick a smaller, watermelon that won't take as long to get to maturity.
So be selective on the kind of seed
right.
that you're going to plant. We missed Pat too. He says, I planted some flowers and vegetables. The first day when I came out to water, there was a raccoon crawling over the fence
oh, man.
That took about half my plants. Oh, I was dumbfounded. The second morning, I saw a possum eat the rest. Oh, my gosh, Pat.
Oh, my gosh.
He
wow.
says, who knew?
Gardening with wildlife.
I know. Who knew we had so many animals in the city who would eat our plants? There's really nothing you can do about that unless you're willing to enclose them, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So, and yeah.
yeah.
Fences
go ahead,
are a
Catherine.
Good thing. Yeah, just build a fence as tall as you can make it. Even I have a neighbor who's got... He's got a fence with a ceiling on it of chicken wire to keep things out of his garden.
Yeah, I mean, that'll work. It's really not beautiful to look at, but
right,
you want to save your plants. That's the deal. Hey, I got a tweet from Michelle about those five-color peppers. She says they're great. They're gorgeous,
good.
Compact. They grow fantastically in containers. And the small peppers are quite tasty and go from purple to cream to yellow to red as they ripen. Mm. Okay.
Wow. Nice.
But containers, just as you guys said. Let me grab, I think it's more wildlife here from Catherine in Northeast Minneapolis. Hey, Catherine, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Oh, hi there. Over here in Northeast, I want to put a shout out and a word in for those of us who live in townhouses and apartments and condos, because I have gardens in pots, so you don't always need a chunk of land to grow things. And right now my challenge is urban wildlife. Japanese beetles and squirrels and chipmunks are my big problems. And I want to pass on a tip that I have found over the years to keep the squirrels from digging in my pots and, you know, digging up the roots and throwing dirt all over.
Yeah.
They don't like tinfoil and they don't like pebbles. So what I do is I find, you know, little 3-inch or so pebbles and put them on top of the dirt in the pots, because that keeps them from digging through the dirt. But if you don't have rocks, you can go and get some cheap tinfoil at the dollar store and then cut some pieces and put a collar around the edge of the pot and push the tinfoil up to the stem of the plant. Mm-hmm. And this works great for single-stem plants like tomatoes. And then poke a few holes in it for water to drain through, and then put a few pebbles or, you know, toothpicks to hold the tinfoil down to so it won't blow away. And they don't like tinfoil. They don't like to dig through it or the texture or something.
Yeah, and, maybe the flashing scares them too.
So, you know, urban wildlife is a real challenge, and that's my solution. So,
all right.
Those are good solutions.
It's a good one. Yeah, and you don't have to douse the plants with something that you think is going to scare off the squirrels. I think I can fit Leslie in Golden Valley in here. Leslie, are you asking about like an ornamental grass or something?
No, lemongrass is used in Southeast Asian
dishes. Got it. And, an herb,
sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I just, my husband bought this lemongrass plant and plopped it in our herb garden, and now it's big, and it looks like I might need to harvest it, but I know nothing about how to harvest this and when to harvest it.
Julie, I've got about a minute and a half. Lemongrass, how to harvest it? What do you say?
I think you just cut the blades off, and you can cut it up, and you could probably put it in the freezer, and take it out in the winter,
idea.
You know, and then use it. So I'd pre-cut it, I'd chop it like you might chop it for a dish, and then just put it in small bags, and then you can dump it into your dishes as you cook.
Okay, so that means that you could do that with a number of different herbs, Julie. Just freeze them until no.
Right. I freeze basil all the time.
Really?
And you just want to wash it, peel, you know, pull off the leaves, discard the stems. The only one that I do dry is, I do dry sage because it's oilier. So it dries better than it freezes. So a lot of good herb books. If you buy a decent herb book, Rodale's herb book is an excellent one. And that can give you information about how to preserve herbs.
You guys, this was great. You made me, I mean, we needed this. Thank you, Catherine, Julie. Really good
Thank
to
you.
Talk to you today.
Our pleasure.
Garden party, reminisce with my old friend. A chance to share old memories. Play a song again. When it got to the garden party, they all knew my name. No one recognized me. I didn't look the same. But it's all right now. I learned my lesson well. You see, you can't please everyone, so you got to please yourself.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. If you'd like to hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks for listening.